Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Rules, A Short History of What We Live by Lorraine Dastin. Narrated by Kitty Hendricks. 1. Introduction. The Hidden History of Rules. Clues to a Hidden History. This is a short book about a vast topic. We are, all of us, everywhere, always, enmeshed in a web of rules that supports and constrains. Rules fix the beginning and end of the working day and the school year, direct the ebb and flow of traffic on the roads, dictate who can be married to whom and how, situate the fork to the right or the left of the plate, score the runs and walks of baseball games, tame debate in meetings and parliaments, establish what can and cannot be taken on a plane as hand luggage, specify who can vote and when, parse the grammar of a sentence, channel customers into the proper lines at the grocery store, tell pet owners whether their animals are welcome or not, lay down the meter and rhyme scheme of a Petrarchan sonnet, and order the rites of birth and death. And these are just examples of explicit rules, the sort to be found written down on signs and in manuals, handbooks, sacred texts, and legal statutes. Add implicit rules, and the web becomes so densely woven that barely any human activity slips through the mesh. There are the unwritten rules about whether to greet with outstretched hand, or two pecks on the cheek à la Francais, or one à la Belge. How many miles per hour over the posted speed limit will be tolerated without incurring a traffic ticket? How much to tip at what kind of restaurant? When to raise and lower one's voice in conversation? Who should open doors for whom? How often and how loudly an opera may be interrupted with cheers and boos? When to arrive at and when to leave a dinner party? And how long an epic should be? Cultures notoriously differ as to the content of their rules. But there is no culture without rules. Lots of them. A book about all of these rules would be little short of a history of humanity. Rules are so ubiquitous, indispensable, and authoritative that they are taken for granted. How could there ever have been a society without rules? A time before rules? Yet the universality of rules does not imply their uniformity, either across cultures or within historical traditions. Rules exhibit vertiginous variety, not only in their content, but also in their forms. The former has been grist for the mill of travelers and ethnographers ever since Herodotus's, circa 484 to circa 425 BCE, tales of how, from an ancient Greek perspective, in Egypt everything is reversed, though no less regular. The men stay home and weave, while the women go to the market. Women urinate standing up, men sitting down. Even the Nile runs backwards, from south to north. The latter unfurls in the long list of species that belong to the genus of rules, laws, maxims, principles, guidelines, instructions, recipes, regulations, aphorisms, norms, and algorithms, to name just a few. The variety of these species of rules is a clue to a hidden history of what a rule is and does. Since Greco-Roman antiquity, three principal semantic clusters have mapped out the meanings of rules. Chapter 2. Tools of measurement and calculation. Models or paradigms, and laws. The subsequent history of rules is one of proliferation and concatenation, yielding ever more species of rules and ever more exemplars of each species. The result is a cat's cradle of complexity, almost as complex as culture itself. The three meanings of rules, nonetheless, spin out scarlet threads that wind their way through the historical labyrinth over millennia. By adopting a longue durée perspective and canvassing rules from many diverse sources, from monastic orders to cookbooks, From military manuals to legal treatises, from calculation algorithms to practical how-to instructions, this book traces the long career of this ancient trio of meanings in the learned and vernacular traditions that share Greco-Roman roots and that have evolved together over more than two millennia. Chapters 2 and 3 reconstruct how rules functioned as supple models from antiquity through the 18th century. Chapters 4 and 5 describe how algorithms of calculation worked in practice from ancient times until the rise of algorithms of mechanical calculation during the 19th and 20th centuries. Chapters 6 and 7 contrast rules at their most specific as nitty-gritty regulations, with rules at their most general as Olympian natural laws and laws of nature from the 13th through the 18th centuries. Chapter 8 examines how moral, legal, and political rules bend and break in the face of recalcitrant exceptions from the 16th through the 20th centuries. Three oppositions structure this long history of rules. Rules can be either thick or thin in their formulation, flexible or rigid in their application, and general or specific in their domains. These oppositions can overlap, and some are more relevant than others, depending on which of the three kinds of rule is in question. Rules understood as models tend to be thick in formulation and flexible in application. Chapters 2 and 3. A thick rule is upholstered with examples, caveats, observations, and exceptions. It is a rule that anticipates wide variations in circumstances and therefore requires nimble adaptation. Thick rules incorporate at least hints of this variability in their very formulation. In contrast, rules understood as algorithms tend to be thinly formulated and rigidly applied, though they too can sometimes thicken. Chapters 4 and 5. An algorithm need not be brief, but it is seldom designed to deal with unusual or simply diverse cases, because thin rules implicitly assume a predictable, stable world in which all possibilities can be foreseen. They do not invite the exercise of discretion. This is unproblematic when the thin rules are confined to solving textbook problems, for example, in simple arithmetic. But the annals of computer algorithms are by now full of cautionary tales about programs for everything from facial recognition to paying your taxes that were tailored too thinly and enforced too rigidly to fit a more variegated reality. Both thick and thin rules can be either minutely specific, a model for making this kind of table out of this kind of wood, or an algorithm for computing the area of this irregular polygon only, or sweepingly general. Rules understood as laws can also run the gamut from specific regulations governing parking on this street on Sundays to the generality of the Decalogue, or the second law of thermodynamics, chapters 6 and 7. Both specific and general laws can be applied either rigidly or flexibly. Rules that teem with specifics, like the sumptuary regulations discussed in Chapter 6, may need some give in application, if only because the specifics change so quickly. And even the most general laws of all, understood as divine commands that are eternally and universally binding, may also, on occasion, be bent. Chapter 8. These oppositions should be understood as marking the extremes of a spectrum of possibilities, rather than as all-or-nothing complements. The chapters that follow illustrate how rules, whether conceived as models, algorithms, or laws, differ by degrees in thinness and thickness, rigidity and flexibility, specificity and generality. Although not all combinations are equally possible, a long history like this one can stretch the present-day imagination with examples of rule regimes that have become rare, such as algorithms formulated thickly and applied flexibly. Chapter 4. Rules are a betwixt and between category. In ancient and medieval schemes of knowledge, they occupied the middle territory between lofty sciences like natural philosophy, which aimed at certain knowledge of universal causes, and the most lowly, mindless, repetitive gestures of unskilled workmen. The province of rules was the arts, those branches of practical knowledge and know-how that blended reason and experience, guidelines that could be taught and savvy that could only be acquired through practice. Chapter 3. In early modern polities, rules were situated between local regulations overflowing with local specifics and universal natural laws valid for everyone, everywhere, always. Analogously, rules in early modern science were regularities too specific to qualify as grand laws of nature, but too general to count as isolated observations. For example, the rule that water expands rather than contracts when it freezes, versus the law of universal gravitation, as valid for the remotest planets as for the apple that falls from this tree. Chapter 6 and 7. Rules define both social and natural orders of a middling sort, always mediating between extremes of certainty and chance, generality and specificity, perfect order and utter chaos. All of these contrasts boil down to one big contrast, a world of high variability, instability, and unpredictability, versus one in which the future can be reliably extrapolated from the past. Standardization ensures uniformity, and averages can be trusted. Although the episodes recounted in this book trace a rough historical arc from the former world to the latter, there is no inexorable dynamic of modernity at work here. An island of stability and predictability in a tumultuous world, no matter what the epoch or locale, is the arduous and always fragile achievement of political will, technological infrastructure, and internalized norms. At any moment, it can be suddenly overwhelmed by war, pandemic, natural disaster, or revolution. In such emergencies, thin rules suddenly thicken. Rigid rules become rubbery. General rules wax specific. It is telling that such explosions of uncertainty are called states of exception. Chapter 8. States in which rules temporarily lose their hold. If rules are changed too often and too quickly to keep up with dynamic circumstances, the very idea of a rule can start to wobble. Epilogue. Rules as both paradigms and algorithms. Rules provide a rich vein to be mined for philosophical problems and projects. The most ancient and enduring problem, inspired by rules, is how universals can be made to fit a potential infinity of particulars that cannot be foreseen by the rule maker. This problem is as old as philosophy itself, and still very much with us. All the chapters in this book describe how this problem was addressed in different settings and in different periods, whether in the law court, the artisan's workshop, or the confessional. I turn to this problem in the next section. But first, I must answer a key question to understanding a second, more modern philosophical problem about rules that listeners will have no doubt posed themselves by this point. Algorithms and laws are still central to our understanding of rules. But whatever happened to the third member of the ancient trio, models or paradigms? Right through the end of the 18th century, this now extinct meaning of rules was robust in both precept and practice. In the course of the 19th and 20th centuries, however, rules as algorithms increasingly edged out rules as paradigms. This shift spawned a second modern philosophical problem about thin rules. Can rules be followed unequivocally, without interpretation or contextualization? And if so, how is this possible? As we shall see in Chapter 5, this is a problem that can hardly ever be formulated until the prototypical rule shifted from being a model or paradigm to being an algorithm, especially an algorithm executed by a machine. This shift is remarkably recent, and its consequences are still reverberating in philosophy, administration, military strategy, and the ever-expanding domains of daily life conducted online. Although algorithms are as old as the operations of arithmetic, and the associations of rules with quantitative exactitude stretch back to Greco-Roman antiquity and beyond, algorithms were rarely the primary sense of rule in the intellectual traditions stemming from ancient Mediterranean cultures, even in mathematics. When dictionaries of European vernaculars began to be published in the 17th and 18th centuries, algorithm featured as the third or fourth definition under the lemma rules, if it appeared at all. The most comprehensive mathematical encyclopedia of the 19th century, a seven-volume German behemoth, did not even contain an entry for algorithm. Yet only a few decades after its publication, algorithms had become central to understanding the essence of mathematical proof. And by the mid-20th century, they were powering the computer revolution and conjuring dreams of everything from artificial intelligence to artificial life. We are now all subjects of the empire of algorithms. This empire was barely a dot on the conceptual map until the early 19th century. Algorithms play an important role in many mathematical traditions all over the world, some quite ancient, and material aids to calculations such as pebbles, counting rods, and knotted strings are also widespread. Chapter 4. But the idea that many forms of human labor, including mental labor, might be reduced to algorithms, much less algorithms mechanically executed, seems to have taken hold only in the 19th century. Chapter 5. Before remarkable experiments applied the economic principles of the division of labor to monumental calculation projects during the French Revolution, the machination of rules, even the humble algorithms of arithmetic, had seemed a doomed project. The calculating machines invented by Blaise Pascal, 1623 to 1662, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, 1646 to 1716, and others in the 17th century, remained little more than ingenious toys, finicky and unreliable. The improbable rise of the algorithm and its transformation from trivial arithmetic operation to safeguard of mathematical rigor to endlessly adaptable programming language for computers is a story that has been told often and well. However, the triumph of algorithms for everything has obscured how narrowly algorithms were still associated with calculation, as late as the mid-20th century, even by computer pioneers such as the American physicist Howard Aiken, 1900 to 1973, who famously opined that a few computers ought to suffice for the needs of the nation, by which he meant the needs of massive calculation for undertakings like the U.S. Census. One aim of this book is to throw light on a crucial earlier episode in this rags-to-riches history, how mathematical algorithms intersected with political economy during the Industrial Revolution, a story that is as much about the history of work and machines as it is about the history of calculation. Rules were many things before they became first and foremost algorithms, that is, instructions subdivided into steps so small and unambiguous that even a machine could execute them. Some of these earlier genres of rules would still be readily recognizable as such, including laws, rituals, and recipes. But perhaps the most central meaning of rule from antiquity through the Enlightenment is no longer associated with rules at all. The rule as model or paradigm. Indeed, in 20th century philosophy, this once primary sense of rule, listed first in dictionary entries well into the 18th century, and still invoked by Immanuel Kant, 1724 to 1804, is diametrically opposed to rules. What kind of model could serve as a rule? The model could be a person who embodies the order rules sustain, such as the abbot of a monastery in the Rule of Saint Benedict, Chapter 2, or a work of art or literature that defines a genre by exemplum, in the way that the Iliad defined the epic in the tradition from the Aeneid to Paradise Lost, or a well-chosen example in grammar or algebra that teaches the salient properties of a much larger class of verbs or word problems. Whatever form the model takes, it must point beyond itself. Mastering the competence embodied by the model goes well beyond being able to copy the model in all its details. Models are to be emulated, not imitated. A writer who reproduced a famous work of literature word for word, as in the Borges story, in which the protagonist attempts to produce parts of Miguel de Cervantes' Don Quixote verbatim, would not be following, but rather repeating the rule as model. To follow such a rule involves understanding which aspects of the model are essential and which are merely accidental details. Only the essential features can forge a reliable and analogical chain between the rule as model and new applications. Reasoning from precedent and common law traditions supplies a familiar example of rules as models in analogical action. Not every past case of manslaughter can be plausibly presented as a precedent for the one at hand, and not every detail of even a convincing precedent will match up with the present case. The way seasoned jurists deliberate over legal precedents highlights the difference between a mere example, this or that manslaughter case, and a model or paradigm, a load-bearing precedent with broad implications for many manslaughter cases. The serviceable paradigm must exhibit a high ratio of essential to accidental details and radiate as many analogies as a porcupine does quills. The modern locus classicus for the opposition between rules and paradigms in philosophy is historian and philosopher of science Thomas Kuhn's 1922-96 Influential Structure of Scientific Revolutions, 1962, a book that sold hundreds of thousands of copies and was once a fixture in university courses across the disciplines. It was also the book that turned paradigm into a household word and the stuff of New Yorker cartoons. According to Kuhn, a science becomes worthy of the name when it acquires its first paradigm. Scientists learn how to solve problems, and indeed what constitutes a problem by textbook paradigms. Scientific revolutions are nothing more or less than the dethronement of one paradigm by another. Just because it was such an all-purpose tool, the word paradigm had many meanings in Kuhn's book, 21 by one count. There was, however, one sense of paradigm that Kuhn himself consistently underscored as the most important, namely paradigms as exemplars, as opposed to sets of rules. In his 1969 postscript to The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, Kuhn described this sense of paradigm as models or examples that can replace explicit rules as a basis for the solution of the remaining puzzles of normal science, as philosophically deeper than the others, even though he was at a loss to explain exactly how it worked. Forestalling charges of irrationalism and woolly-mindedness, he stoutly defended the knowledge transmitted by paradigms as genuine knowledge. When I speak of knowledge embedded in shared exemplars, I am not referring to a mode of knowing that is less systematic or less analyzable than knowledge embedded in rules, laws, or criteria of identification. But, to date, neither Kuhn nor anyone else has succeeded in clarifying that alternative mode of knowing, a perplexity. Philosopher Ian Hacking concluded, in the nature of the beast. Kuhn's perplexity about how to reconcile the knowledge of paradigms with that of explicit rules already had an illustrious philosophical pedigree by 1969. In his Philosophical Investigations, 1953, Ludwig Wittgenstein 1889 to 1951, famously argued for the incorrigible ambiguity of even mathematical rules. How is it possible to follow rules, he asked, even the most formal and algorithmic rules, without setting off an infinite regress of interpretations of the rule? Wittgenstein concluded that to follow a rule is a practice, taught by example rather than by precept within a community of users. To obey a rule, to make a report, to give an order, to play a game of chess, are customs, uses, institutions. Ironically, and possibly unwittingly, Wittgenstein's proposal returns the rule back to its original meaning, as a model taught by practice, rather than by precept. But for his many readers, including Kuhn, explicit rules, epitomized by the mathematical algorithm, were the polar opposite of paradigms and practices. So it comes as something of a shock to learn that for most of its history, the word for rule and its cognates in ancient and modern European languages, from ancient Greece and Rome through the Enlightenment, were synonymous with paradigm. Here, for example, is the Roman encyclopedist Pliny the Elder, circa 23 to 79 CE, upholding the Greek sculptor Polykleitos's, circa 480 to circa 420 BCE, statue Doryphoros, the spearbearer, as the canona, the Latinized version of the Greek word for rule, canon, the model of male beauty worthy of imitation by all artists. He also made what artists call a canon, or model statue, as they draw their artistic outlines from it as from a sort of standard. Or Dionysius of Halicarnassus, circa 60 to circa 7 BCE, praising the 5th century BCE Attic orator Lysias, circa 445 to circa 380 BCE, as the canon of rhetoric, immediately glossed in the next sentence as the paradigm, paradigma, of excellence. Or, fast-forwarding almost 2,000 years to Enlightenment France, here is the Encyclopédie's sample sentence for its first definition of the entry, Règle modèle, the life of our Savior is the rule or the model for Christians. In both ancient Greek and Latin grammars, the words canon and regula were used along with paradigma to denote that paradigm of paradigms, the patterns of inflections, such as verb conjugations, intoned by schoolchildren over the centuries, amo, amas, amat, etc. At first glance, this may seem to be yet one more intriguing example of the bizarrerie of languages, in which words occasionally flip-flop into their opposites, but no more than that. Once upon a time, long ago, a word meant A. Now it means not A. Rule, canon, regula, once meant a model or paradigm. Now it means exactly the opposite. Hence Kuhn's conundrum of how to clarify paradigms without reducing them to rules. That is, without reducing A to not A. And also the provocatively paradoxical quality of Wittgenstein's equation of rule following with usage and custom. But the etymology of the pre-modern cognates for rule is both richer and more unsettling than this developmental account from meaning A to meaning not A would suggest. The more familiar modern associations of the word are also part of the definition of the pre-modern cognates of rule. The ancient Greek word canon, for example, connoted painstaking exactitude, especially in connection with the arts of building and carpentry, but also in a figurative sense, when applied to other domains such as art, politics, music, and astronomy. The same Polykleitos, who fashioned the Doryphoros statue, was the author of a lost treatise entitled Canon, in which he allegedly specified the exact proportions of the human body to be followed by artists. Such prescriptive measurements of classical statues were still on display in the 18th century. Via Greek physician and philosopher Galen's 129 circa 2.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?